sports world keeps on turning. That's why we bring you Saturday Sports Talk. Kick your weekend off with the week's top headlines in sports. Get in the game by calling 656-9900 or toll free at 1-866-656-9900. Star 99 is a free call for AT&T and U.S. Cellular customers. This is Saturday Sports Talk. Sports Talk on 99.1 The Sports Animal.
Good Saturday morning. Beautiful day here on Rocky Top. This is Saturday Sports Talk on The Sports Animal. So glad to have you guys along for the ride. I'm Eric Kane. Appreciate you listening. Vince Ferrara joining me and Logan Ward through the glass. I want to remind you guys, of course, we'll be on the air for the next hour from 10 until noon. It'll be the lead lap with Ron Morton, Callie, and Chris Corum. And then at 12 o'clock, it'll be a special pregame show with a special pregame interview before at 12:20. We'll have our Vol Network Classic game, as we've done this kind of the series the last 6 or 7 weeks or so. Today's game, it'll be the overtime victory over Florida back in that 1998 season. So tune in at noon for a pregame show. Kickoff will be at 12:20. And Vince, I think this has been a really, really cool thing that we've been able to do in cahoots with the Vol Network over the course of the last couple of months during this time.
It has been awesome, and with the love and respect for John Ward that so many in Vol Nation have, they get a chance to hear his game calls as well. So that's another really neat aspect of it. And T. Martin will be the pregame interview as John and Jimmy caught up with him and talked to him about, you know, that not only that game in 98, but that you know, that championship season as well. So that'll be a part of that broadcast, and we'll continue it on during the sports shutdown of those Vol Network Classics every Saturday at noon.
Yes, so we're live and local here for the better part of a Saturday, as we always are, and looking forward to that. It'll be a good one. Again, 12 o'clock will be that pregame interview with T. Martin. 12:20 will be kickoff, the 1998 overtime victory against Florida during that national championship run. All right, I've been teasing it all morning. We're about to replay an interview, VFL Charles Davis, who was a part of the Sugar Vols, playing for the Vols back in the 1980s, the mid-80s. His head coach was Johnny Majors, and he joined John and Jimmy this week on Sports Talk following the passing of Coach Majors. Some really great, insightful stuff here. Of course, Charles Davis is one of the best broadcasters you know, that we're lucky to hear and watch each and every Sunday, that covering NFL games. Now with CBS. So looking forward to hearing him this fall. But right now, let's go back and revisit an interview with VFL Charles Davis on Johnny Majors. This was on Sports Talk Thursday afternoon.
When somebody mentions the name of Coach John Majors, what comes to mind for you?
Well, immediately you get scared. I mean, you're like, oh, is he here? Is he here? You know, that's the first thing. And you're wondering if he's going to get into your drill and tell you how you're doing things wrong and how you got to shape it up. And you know, and all of a sudden, you know, it's funny how his voice gets, his name gets mentioned, and every thought that comes to your head is in his voice. And then you find yourself doing his voice. It's just, it's one of those things, you know, there are people in this world that are like that, right? You know, I had a boss when I worked at the Olympic Committee, who's one of my mentors, Dr. Harvey W. Schiller.
Yeah.
And I can be with people that I worked with back then, and his name comes up, and you see an unconscious shifting where we all straighten up in our chairs, our eyes start darting around like he's going to come around the corner. You know, I remember a colleague of mine, she said, every time I hear his name, I just have that immediate spasm of fear. But doesn't mean we didn't love him. Doesn't mean we didn't, you know, appreciate what he did for us, all of those things. With Coach Majors, you know, it's been funny because, as you might imagine, you know, the text messages, the calls, you know, we're all doing that today, right? We're all looking for comfort with each other, making sure, you know, all of ours are doing okay, handling the news, got the news, all that. And then the stories start. And you guys know, I mean, you've been around a lot, and you've got your own set of stories as well. But, you know, some of the stories you've heard, some of them have been new to emerge. I mean, it's been a heck of a day. So I think that's the way we've tried to get through a lot of this.
You said that you could safely say that playing for Johnny Majors is one of the greatest experiences of my life. Why?
Yeah. You got to understand, and I'll try for once in my life to be somewhat brief. I was born in East Tennessee, right? Elizabethan, Tennessee. My mom's from there. My dad's from West Virginia. Okay? Tennessee had a big imprint on me, even though I didn't live there. We moved to New York State when I was two, but all my mom's relatives, we'd go back and forth. The name Majors very quickly is always followed by Tennessee. If you say the word Tennessee in the context, especially of football, the name Majors comes up very quickly. He was a giant before I ever met him, okay, before I ever knew who he was. So that was a big part of it. Then I get to go and play for him, all right? So now, wow, this is unbelievable because it was a lifelong dream for me to play at Tennessee, especially once Coach Majors left Pitt. Because you have to remember, growing up in New York State, I got to see Pitt play a lot.
Yeah.
All right, Eastern football, this is before the Big East, right? We didn't, you know, Penn State hadn't gone and joined the Big Ten. This is long before any of that. So Eastern football, when Pitt got good and now could challenge Penn State and beat Penn State and Tony Dorsett, or Tony Dorsett,
yep,
as Coach Majors used to call him, Tony Dorsett, you know, before he changed his name, you know, that was a big deal. So to watch that and see that all evolve, and then, of course, he went back to his alma mater, which – I was thrilled about because I always wanted to be a Tennessee player. But bottom line is, guys, once I got there and went through everything, and, yes, you know, there's times like any coach, you're like, what am I doing playing for this maniac? You also realize the lessons that were there, the care that he actually had for you, even though there's times you were wondering about that. And, of course, we were able to accomplish something with him that he was brought back to do. And we were a part of that first group to get that done, which was win the SEC and win the Sugar Bowl, because that's what he was brought back to get done. He got called home just like Coach Bryant did, right? Coach Bryant said he left Texas A&M because Bama called. If you were really in your right mind looking at the rebuild job that faced him at Tennessee versus what he had left at Pitt, would you have left? No. Jackie Sherrill was very happy that went down like that. Because Jackie Sherrill took over, and I'm not saying that he didn't do a good job, but Coach Sherrill was a heck of a coach. We know that. He took Mississippi State to an SEC championship game. Come on now. Man knows what he's doing. But he took over a loaded program. And I think he went 33-3-1 before he left for Texas A&M. So Coach Majors could have very well stayed there and ridden that out. And who knows? With any luck, maybe he wins another national title.
Charles, it is great to catch up, and I'm just wondering, we got to speak with David Moon earlier, and he talked about this, David. But how different was the relationship player to coach, and then to get to know Coach Majors after your time was done, and really be more friends than it was? And now, I realize you're always player and coach, but I'm just wondering, what was it like for the relationship to evolve the way it did over time?
Yeah, I have no idea what David said, but I think I have a decent idea of it. And what it is you see some of that, you get glimpses of it as a player if you are doing the right things, right? And he's not having to, you know, discipline you, or you're not a problem in the classroom and things of that nature. So you get glimpses of it where he would share that side of him about what he was reading lately. You know, have you read this? Have you read this, young man? This is great stuff. And then, of course, he wanted to make sure he gave you information that you didn't know so that you would know that he had read it. You know what I mean? So where they got that from? And let me tell you how this all came about. And you're like, okay, got it. That was big. But then when you became, you know, an ex-player, now you're off trying to make it in the world and you're trying to be successful, yeah, you get to know a little bit more. You get to see a little bit more. Your conversations go a little bit deeper than whether or not you're going to be ready to go on Saturday and did you go to class that week? Yeah, I think I know where David's going with that. And for me, staying in the athletics world as a worker, that allowed me even more access and more times that I might call our coach or want something or try and get his advice or just have someone to talk to about certain things. So, yeah, there was a big part of that because I was always encountering him in my job. You know what I mean? You know, National Football Foundation in New York City, or this was going on. And then, as you guys know, Coach got around pretty well to a lot of different places. You know, remember when Mike Ruzioni from the hockey team was America's guest?
Yes.
I think Coach did a pretty good imitation of that one. And people were always inviting him back to things because – he left an imprint a lot of places between Iowa State, Pitt, Tennessee, Arkansas, right on down the line. People always want Coach back.
Charles, in regard to Coach Majors, we thought it was interesting. We interviewed Bobby, his brother, earlier, who said that Johnny tried to get him to go to Iowa State, and he said there was no way. He would have been too rough on me. I didn't want to play for my brother. But he also said –
That's a good thought.
He said two things. I asked him this. The two things that if you had to narrow it down that made Coach Majors such a successful coach, his attention to detail and his demand for excellence. As someone that played for him, would you agree with that assessment?
Absolutely. The attention to detail was, you know, everything that you did. I mean, there was times where he would talk to us about the pads that were left on the field after practice and go back and pick them up, picking up your locker room and policing up your area and having some respect and pride for it. Seems like a small thing, but there's a repetition in that as well. You know, he was, you know, just a listing every week of the chart who was going to the hotel, you know, for a home game or who was traveling. And believe me, even though I was a starter, I looked every week just to make sure. I wanted to make sure I was going. And those sorts of things. And I'll put you this way. I'll give you two quick ones. Well, I'll give you one quick one for sure. He called me in one time and made me sweat. You know how they, you know, coaches, you know, bosses make you sweat it out sitting there. I'm just sitting there just like, oh, God, I have no idea what this is about. And finally, you remember how coaches keep those index cards?
Yes.
In his shorts at practice. You always saw him writing notes. Well, in that John Major scrawl, he slid a card across. He had those glasses down at the end of his nose. Charles, read that card. So I'm reading. He goes, out loud. Okay. And it said, remind yourself to chew Charles's ass about how he's playing cover two. That's what the card said. And I just looked up at him after I read it, and he goes, well, do you understand? And I was like, well, I'm supposed to. He goes, ah, you don't understand. And he gets up, and he starts demonstrating what he wants. And then you know that little crooked finger he had? And he gave me that crooked finger in my face, and he said, so you're going to start playing it the way I just told you, aren't you, young man? Yes, sir. Now get down. Let's get going now. Pick it up. Yes, sir. I went flying out of that office. And I don't think – my feet hit the ground the rest of that entire practice. I know my roommate that night was like, dude, are you on something? I said, man, coach lit me up today. If I don't start getting it going, my butt's going to be on the bench. So I remember that well. I remember one time he jumped into our drills. And you guys remember when he came out of that tower, right? When you heard coach on the loudspeaker, and let's be honest about it, when he yelled in the loudspeaker, what was the percentage of what we actually understood of what he said? 40% max? but you knew when he was ticked off, and you'd hear, yes! You're like, oh, shoot. And then your coach would go, if he comes out of that tower, I'm going to run you. And then he would come flying out of that tower. You know how it circles its way down, right? And what I always used to crack up about was he'd get to the bottom, and he'd have to take a few breaths because he's a little out of breath, and then he'd start back again to where he was going, and the whole field, everyone on all the fields were watching to see which direction he went, because if he came in your direction, you're like, uh-oh, but if he went in the other direction, like, woo, we're off the hook, he's going somewhere else, and he came over one time, and he's like, what are you doing? I said, shut up. Just get out of the way. And he threw me out of the drill. And you remember when coach wanted to demonstrate, what would he do first? He'd take that hat. And he'd turn it backwards.
Yeah. Yep.
And he'd turn the hat backwards. And he'd take the whistle and throw it behind his neck. And he's like, now I'm going to show you how to play this coverage. You don't know what you're doing out here. I used to coach the secondary, you know. Yes, sir. So I'm standing there. Run to play. And they ran the play. And, of course, the speed of it and everything. He didn't come anywhere near it, right? Run it again. So I promise you guys, he ran it three times and didn't come anywhere near demonstrating what he was trying to demonstrate. But, of course, I'm not going to be laughing. I'm standing there like, oh, God, right? Now, he is beyond ticked off at this point. He's 0-for-3. Okay. He's mad at me because I can't get it right. And he turns around and he looks at me and announces to everyone in the vicinity, "Well, Charles, you effed up that coverage so badly, no one can play it," and turned and walked away. So there's your attention to detail, guys.
I got to ask about this. So what was it like the night you played Miami in the Sugar Bowl? What was that locker room like before you took the field?
I think by now, if you're a Tennessee fan, and if you haven't, please find it. And it's not too hard to find, I don't believe, right? You have the locker room pregame speech, right, Coach Majors?
Mm-hmm.
I thought that may have been his finest hour because of this. Not because the speech was so good. And obviously the speech is good because of what? We won. You know how that is. It's like Ohio State fans still go back to Jim Tressel's talk before they beat Miami in the Fiesta Bowl, right? But if they don't win the game, we don't know that he ever gave that talk, okay? But because you win, now those things get elevated. Well, it was still a terrific speech. Not because he wove in, you know, incredible eloquence and he brought in, you know, all these great quotes. It was the quiet confidence that he exhibited to our team, because he had been telling us the entire time we were good enough. And you guys remember going into that Miami game, we were probably, what, double-digit dogs? And that Miami team was supposed to roll us and then claim a national championship because Oklahoma and Penn State were playing in the Orange Bowl. And they had gone to Norman that year, Miami did, and beat the heck out of Oklahoma, broke Troy Aikman's ankle, and he never played another game at Oklahoma. They went back to the wishbone with Jamel Holloway and rolled to the Orange Bowl. And then when they beat Penn State and we beat Miami, Oklahoma won another national title. And to this day, when I see Coach Switzer, he says the same thing every single time. "Ah, Charlie, ha-ha, won another one. Thank you, guys. Thank you." That's because of what we did that night. So that was a big part. But what Coach did in that locker, if you watch that speech, you will not get, "Guys, we have to play a perfect game tonight. Guys, we can't make mistakes against this team. They're so good. We've got to play above ourselves." He didn't say that. What he told us that night and what he'd been building up to was, "You're good enough to do this if you just play your game." Now, you guys have seen and heard that speech. You know what I'm talking about. There was never an element of, "Okay, guys, woo, we got a challenge tonight." No, it was, "We're good enough to beat anyone in the country if we play our game."
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he had built us up to at that point. And he didn't take us above and beyond that night, because that would have been a mistake. It would have been contradicting everything he had taught us or told us in that month leading up to the game. And I thought he hit it really well that night in retrospect.
That's incredible. What was it like in terms of, was the approach any different when you played the quote-unquote big games? Alabama, which I guess you were, your first 3 years in Tennessee, you didn't see a loss to a, you weren't a part of a loss to the Crimson Tide. But was there any difference between the big game, so to speak, and just getting in preparations 1 week to the next?
He tried not to. He used to talk about Team X all the time. You got to treat each week like you're playing Team X. We used to laugh about that all the time. But you guys better be careful. That X is pretty good now. Team X, they're always the same. But when he tried to keep it that way, but let's be honest about it. Anyone who tells you that you're getting ready to play Auburn when they're number one, when you're getting ready to play Alabama any year, that you treat that the same as any other, that's a lie. Okay, there's just no getting around it. It doesn't mean that you've put in 37 different things that you wouldn't put in for other people, but how you go about it, what the intensity level is, right? You're trying to keep it grounded, and you're trying not to peak too early, but at the same time, you're going to tell me that getting ready for Wake Forest is the same as getting ready for Bama? We all know that's not true. It's just not the way it is, and that's the problem, because sometimes you're not ready, and Wake could jump up and bite you, right? You know, mm-hmm. Army got us a couple of times, that sort of a deal. But, for the most part, he tried to keep it that way. But a lot of that would happen, frankly, guys, in the off season. And you remember the year we beat Auburn And John, I got to tell you, the proud Vol, and you know, we're all tired of this Bama stuff because they're pretty darn good. I had a redshirt year, so I consider myself 4-for-5 against Bama.
Okay? Oh, well, yeah, you all sure right. are.
Yeah. All right, so let's, you know, let's make sure we get that part in there. Now, the fifth one we don't want to talk about. Okay?
That's right. What fifth
that
one?
That one we're gonna let go because I think we were losing at halftime like 42-14, and it was so bad it felt like 92. And I remember sitting there and Coach snapped at the half. Right, and ordinarily he was very clinical at halftime, but he lost it. Forget going to your meet. Everybody up. And he said, do you know that they can score 70 points? And I remember sitting there going, well, heck, Coach, they got 42 in the first half. If you double it, that's 80. Yeah, they can score 70. And obviously you didn't say anything like that, but, you know, it was just one of those deals. But the way that he would get you going was really in the off season, because the year we beat Auburn when they were number one was the 85 when we went to the Sugar Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
That started, frankly, at the Sun Bowl in 84 in El Paso. I screwed up a coverage and got beat for a touchdown by Farrell Edmonds, okay, who later was a number one pick of the Dolphins. And I tried to always throw that in there to let you know he was pretty good. I wasn't just a scrub, okay? And I get beat for this touchdown. It was the worst chewing I ever got in my life at Tennessee. He met me at the hash mark coming off the sideline after they scored. And you know how Charlie Brown's teacher does that womp, 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 womp?
Yes.
By the time we got to the sideline, that's all I heard, except for an occasional blankety blank, like, you know, a couple of those slid through. And all my teammates, Tommy Sims, Terry Brown, all those guys, they slid way down the bench. And I got all the way to the bench. The coach chewed me all the way to the bench. I mean, just lit me up. And we get done with the whole thing. And Zook, Coach Ron Zook, comes running. He comes charging up at me. He wants a piece of me. And I threw my hand up at him and said, I'm just going to tell you straight up, I'm hanging on by a very thin thread. If you're going to bench me, then you can yell all you want. But if you want me to play, there's no more yelling. It's the only time I ever talked like that to a coach. And he actually didn't yell, and I played. Bottom line was, we get beat that day, guys. We get in the locker room after the game, and Coach Major says, seniors, thank you for your service. Good luck in life. Make sure you come back and see us. Make us proud. As for the rest of you, and I went, oh boy, here it goes. He said, I will never coach a team like the one we had here. We're going to be tougher. We're going to be more physical. We're going to do this. He said, make sure you get in shape in your off-season winter conditioning programs. Make sure you go to class. He said, because, gentlemen, spring practice will be a bloodbath, I promise you. And he used the word bloodbath. And I went, well, there goes Christmas. And sure enough, we come back the next year, and spring practice, they introduced the new – remember the old gauntlet drill? Remember that one?
Yeah.
They introduced the gauntlet to us, which was an extended Oklahoma drill.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we stretched. The first day of spring practice, we stretched and went right to gauntlet. And that was spring, the entire spring. 20 straight days of pads, beat each other to death, no 20-hour rule, none of that stuff, blah, blah, blah. How did it pay off? We were as physical as Auburn the next year. We beat Auburn. We go on. We win the SEC. So when you're asking about getting ready for the big game, he was getting ready for Auburn right then and there because he was tired of it. And I had heard a story that's unsubstantiated that Coach Dye, God bless his soul, we lost him on Monday, that apparently he told Coach Majors that we were as talented as his Auburn teams, but we just weren't as tough as his kids. And apparently Coach Majors went after him at a coach's meeting. They had to break it up.
I could see that.
But you could see that, right? Because you could see that bulldog jaw. And, you know, that's kind of one of those things. I can say that about my kids. But you can't say that about my kids.
Right.
And I don't know if the story's true or apocryphal, but I'd like to believe it was true or there was some truth to it. And he brought that back to us. So if you're asking how we got ready for big games, that was one way. You just did it in the off season.
That's VFL Charles Davis of CBS, obviously one of the best analysts covering the NFL. nowadays. And of course, he was one of many great interviews we had on Sports Talk, on The Sports Animal, you know, all of our shows over the course of the past couple of days. So again, that was Charles Davis. You want to hear more, 99.1thesportsanimal.com. So many interviews on the life of Johnny Majors. All right, we'll continue to roll on here on Saturday Sports Talk. More in-person voluntary workouts conversations to begin about. Alabama had a couple of players testing positive for COVID-19 and a fun exercise to end our show. More to come with Vince Ferrara. I am Eric Kane here on Saturday Sports Talk, The Sports Animal. Eric Kane, along with Vince Ferrara, here on Saturday Sports Talk. 656-9900, 1-866-656-9900. You want to get in on the line? Got about 30 minutes left of the show. I'm perusing through Twitter this morning, Vince, and I see a tweet from Jamie Hyatt, who's the father of a 2020 signee for Tennessee, Jalen Hyatt, and they're dropping off their son here at campus today. And, of course, that's the case for many of the incoming freshmen who are moving in today. And Tennessee, along with other SEC programs, expected to get in-person voluntary workouts off and running beginning this week. And some news that came out of Tuscaloosa a couple days ago, Vince, and according to a 24/7 report, five Alabama football players have tested positive for COVID-19, and a little alarming that it was already out of the gate, but I feel like this is something that we knew was going to happen. It's kind of like a petri dish. When you get, you know, larger groups of people together, it's going to kind of happen. So it's not shocking at all that you're going to get some positive tests. I think it's how these programs and these universities, you know, what is their plan? How do you react to that?
Yeah, you don't want to have anybody test positive for it. But like you mentioned, it's going to happen. The key is with that testing before they ever get on campus, and that's how these universities are doing it. Before they ever get around all their teammates, they're getting tested and done so thoroughly to where you can keep them quarantined, and then it delays them getting on campus, and you don't have the spread of it. The question will be is, even though they're getting tested now and they will get tested later, what happens if someone tests positive once they're around their teammates within those workouts? Then what do you do? Who else goes in quarantine with them? How do you, you know, go back and track who they were around and determine who needs to be under quarantine? And that's for workouts now, but that's a question for when we get, you know, into training camp and perhaps into the season. That's still, I think, an unknown in how exactly they're going to handle it. Right now, it seems like sort of a case-by-case type of thing, depending on who they were around. But you wonder how much of a shutdown that will be if someone does test positive for it that has been around all their teammates, even if they, you know, do their best to try to have those social distancing measures.
Yeah, according to this report from Bama Online, again, this is the 24/7 site for Alabama football. Just reading from the release, it says, according to an SEC release in late May, Alabama and teams across the league have a plan as immediate isolation followed by contact tracing of team members who are diagnosed is suggested. So, again, those are some suggestions, but what exactly is that plan? I think that immediately you would go into some isolation. You would test those that you are around, obviously, in workout groups and or roommates, suite mates, whatever it may be. But again, it's, you know, you knew this was going to happen, and so this isn't shocking. But, you know, moving forward, I think it's just important to remember that, you know, every university, Alabama, Tennessee, Georgia, making strict, you know, plans to where you will have a mask on at all times unless you're outside, you know, running while you're, you know, inside the facility and taking part in these workouts. They have, you know, spaced out machines and trying to maintain social distancing. You've seen a lot of high schools, you know, as high school football has gotten workouts geared up and going again the last couple of weeks, you know, take a lot of the stuff to the field and spread out. And I think that's a good move. And obviously I think, you know, some colleges will do that as well. But these athletes, again, are going to be tested twice coming on campus. So they're going to be screened daily, going to be taking part in questionnaires, and they're going to be wearing the mask. And so, as far as, you know, the plan stepping into this, the homework has been done, the research has been done, but there will be positive tests. That's just kind of how it's going to be.
Absolutely, there will be. I don't know how you can avoid it. And I think a lot of them that we've seen at a couple of different schools have been asymptomatic.
Yes.
Which is, which even calls more attention to the importance of having those COVID-19 tests. And, you just never know who's a carrier. So you have to do those things to make sure that they don't spread. And look, there's a risk everywhere we go. We're living our everyday lives where there's not testing. You just never know. That's why they encourage the mask, because you don't, even though we could all feel great and not be sick, that doesn't mean that anyone's not a carrier. So it's the proper approach for these schools, and I'm glad those guidelines are there. And we'll see once they break through that, if there are more cases from the inside. That's what you worry about.
Got a really fun exercise we're going to play here in the final segment of the show, coming up in about 6-7 minutes. There was an article from ESPN that was put out a couple days ago about how LSU, Alabama, and Ohio State could build the best current NFL lineup. It's really neat when you go back and play the who's, the names, you match them all up, and we'll run through some of those. But I want to play, what is Tennessee's starting lineup? If you had a Tennessee Volunteer NFL team, who's on that starting lineup right now? So we'll play that coming up here in about 7 minutes. But real quick, Vince, as we wrap up this segment right here before it, I do want to get your opinion on this. There was an article a couple days ago from the New York Times. Mark Emmert had some comments about the college football season on a conference call with the House of Republicans. That was on Wednesday. This was reported on Thursday. And one coming out from the New York Times, Emmert suggested the college football season could be cut short with conference and title games played before Thanksgiving, of course, fearing that second wave of COVID-19 coming through. There's so many hypotheticals, there's so many suggestions and theories and all this, but, say that were to be the case. What if you had to get those title games in before Thanksgiving, or either be right before the weekend before Thanksgiving holiday, or maybe that weekend that falls that Thursday? How will that season kind of look like? I mean, you're obviously going to cut out the bye weeks, which I think is just horrible for college football. Meaning, if you were to do that, everyone needs a bye week. Let me reiterate, every college football team needs a bye week. Really need two. That's why you had two last year. But what might that look like? Did you see the report? Have you given that any type of thought?
I did see it, and what stands out is that final week is rivalry week.
Yeah.
So you can't just chop it. You have to reschedule it somewhere, and that's not easy if the rest of the year is sandwiched in with only one bye week. Some years you get two. This year you only get one. So what if you don't have, and you won't, what if you don't have the same bye week as your rivals? Tennessee doesn't have the same bye week as Vanderbilt. Florida State, Clemson, South Carolina. There's many other examples in that final week. So, Alabama and Auburn. So, if you don't have that same bye week, then you have to adjust many other games or chop a non-conference game and try to make it work. Now, week 13, maybe that's the week before. That's a week that there's fewer conference games, and that's almost like a light game before your rival week, in essence, ends up being a bye week. So just thinking about it, that November 21st weekend might be one where it gets chopped. You try to reschedule the conference games for that week. There's a couple looking at it. There's Alabama, Texas A&M. There's LSU, Auburn, and I think that's it. Kentucky, Georgia is that weekend as well. So there're not a lot of conference games. Everything else, just scanning through, is non-conference. Those are the three conference games for that weekend. So maybe you can push those up into an open week. It may cost you two non-conference weeks to get that conference game in.
Yeah.
And then you move the November 28th week up once you clear out that week before. That might be the shortest term solution for that, but man, it can certainly get messy, and There's a lot of other things that were in there that were, that, you know, were interesting. What if everybody can't start on time?
Yeah.
And when do you know that you can't start on time? What if you have a positive test and you're like, all right, we got to shut this down. We can't start our August practice and you know, for a couple of weeks, and you can't start the season according to that plan unless you have 4 weeks of preseason camp. So now what do you do? Do you just drop the game? Do you try to reschedule it? I mean, those things are – those difficulties, I think we can expect some of that this year.
Yeah, you had this was all stemming from the one conference call with the House of Republicans. New York Times had a really good article about if the season was cut short. Sports Illustrated put out an article about what if you don't start on time or if some teams just don't play. What it comes down to, and all this is concern, really, and we've known this, it's state and local regulations. I mean, where are you in different parts of the country? And it makes complete sense to where some parts of the country could be full go. Other parts might have some regulations, and it could just be an absolute scheduling nightmare. So some really good articles. Again, Sports Illustrated and New York Times both have different reports out there in the last couple of days about Mark Emmert's comments on the college football season with a conference call of the House of Republicans, if you guys want to check that out. All right, so LSU, Alabama, Ohio State, they can all field a pretty stout NFL starting lineup of players that have just hailed from their school right now. What does Tennessee's look like? Vince, during his Vince's view, he breaks down the Vols in the NFL, you know, every couple of weeks. I took part of that. I look at that, and I reference it, and I put together my own lineup, and we'll talk about it when we come back to wrap up this edition of Saturday Sports Talk. With Vince Ferrara, I'm Eric Kane, Logan Moore through the glass, and we'll be back to have a final segment of the show when we return here on The Sports Animal. A little over 7 minutes left in this edition of Saturday Sports Talk. Eric Kane, along with Vince Ferrara. Logan Ward with us as well. Boys, a fun article that I stumbled across a couple of days ago, and it got me thinking, you know, how it would be if Tennessee did this exercise. So essentially, there's so many, you know, good players in the NFL that have come from, you know, programs such as LSU, Ohio State, Alabama. There's others. I mean, there's good players that come from Tennessee, obviously. But the quantity that comes from these programs is kind of mind-blowing. And ESPN kind of broke it down and put together a starting lineup for these programs, both on offense and defense, of current NFL players. And you go through and you look at LSU, of course, at, you know, Joe Burrow, Leonard Fournette, Odell Beckham Jr., Jarvis Landry, Clyde Edwards-Helaire. You continue to go down, and you kind of look at Alabama, and you got Tua, Derrick Henry, Julio Jones, Amari Cooper. You kind of get the point. And there's a lot of really good players, and even on defense, even on the offensive line, the quantity is there. The quality and quantity is there. So I got to thinking, what if we did this for Tennessee? And then I knew that, you know, Vince, a part of your blog series, Vince's Views at 991thesportsanimal.com, you kind of break down where Vols are in the NFL on active rosters, on practice squads, free agents, and all that. So I kind of went and looked, and I said, if we made a starting lineup, a Tennessee Volunteers NFL starting lineup, who would make up that lineup? So I thought we'd kind of go around the room as quickly as we end our show and just kind of, you know, position by position and kind of throw out some names. So I think it's pretty obvious the quarterback, no Peyton Manning anymore. It comes down between Tyler Bray or Josh Dobbs, and both are, you know, second or third stringers. Josh Dobbs has seen action in a game before, so I kind of put him there for me. But Vince, would you go Dobbs over Bray?
Yes, I think Bray has one career pass with the Kansas City Chiefs when he was with them, so it's Dobbs.
Running back is Alvin Kamara. Any objections for you guys?
No, he's the only one.
Oh, there we go. Can't be another one.
But he's as good as one of the best, so yes. That's good.
Would we flirt with Jalen Hurd, though?
Well, Jalen Hurd doesn't play running back.
Well, that's true, but he played running back at Tennessee.
True, he did, but he go ahead, Ben.
No, I was just going to say, just classify those as one-time balls. Mm-hmm. You know, some fans get upset. Guys that left the program and finished elsewhere, transferred, they don't consider them VFLs. I don't get that concept. You're at Tennessee, you're a part of Tennessee history. We just separate and put them in a little bit different category. But there are plenty of those guys in the NFL, too. I think there's like 8 of them right now.
Hey, Vince, this might be a conversation for another day, but guys like Eli Wolf, who graduated then left for a year, would you consider those guys to be in the VFL category?
Yeah, no, Eli Wolf, you're right. Eli Wolf would not be in that category. He would be in Jalen Hurts' category, yeah. But no, since he transferred, no, I wouldn't count him, no.
Okay. Like I said, conversation for another day. You look at wide receiver, I put Josh, my two starters would be Josh Malone, who's with the Jets now, and Cordarrelle Patterson, of course, who's a NFL all-decade team guy as a kick returner, but he's my other receiver.
Yeah, you know, we haven't seen Jennings on the field. I think fans would anticipate, with as much as they're excited about Juwan Jennings and passing a Josh Malone, Cordarrelle Patterson brings you the return game and one of the best returners in the history of the National Football League, and the numbers show that. So we haven't seen Callaway or Jennings, but no, I think the starters should be Malone and Patterson right now.
Tight end, Jason Witten, though he's towards the end of his career, there's quite a few tight ends for Tennessee that's at least on an NFL roster right now. You've got Witten, you have Jason Kroon with the Bills, Yakim Johnson with the Patriots, who kind of plays a little bit of everything in terms of fullback, tight end, H-back. Alex Ellis is with the Eagles, Ethan Wolf with the Rams, and Dominic Wood Anderson with the Seahawks. But
Eric, real quick, I totally made a mistake. Here's the 37th one. It's not Eli Wolf. It's John Kelly. So it's Kamara is not the only running back. It's John Kelly as the backup. So it's those two. But Kamara clearly would get that starting spot. So just wanted to correct that.
Yeah, that's right. John Kelly with the Rams. You're exactly right. But, Kamara would get the nod there. Jason Witten at tight end. When you look at the offensive line, you just had Ramon Foster, who was an outstanding pro that just retired recently. But only three active offensive linemen three that are on NFL rosters right now, hailing from Tennessee. You have Juwan James, who was injured last year, but a fine pro with the Broncos. You have Zach Fulton with the Texans. And then Khalil McKenzie, who's fighting for a roster spot with the Seattle Seahawks.
I mean, doesn't this highlight the recent years and the struggles?
Yes.
The last 10, 11 years of Tennessee football is you haven't had good offensive line play, and you can't even fill out a full team right now. Now you have depth on the defensive line. We'll get to that. But to not even be able to field a team year after year, struggles on the O-line. But that is going to change very soon.
Now, Tennessee, where there has been a plenty of talent and plenty of NFL talent, has been in the front seven defensively, particularly on that front line, the defensive line. My two defensive ends or edge presence, however you want to classify them, I've got Derek Barnett of the Eagles, former first-round pick, and then I have Daryl Taylor, who was just drafted by the Seahawks. Of course, you could also take into account Kyle Phillips, Kendall Vickers, and Jonathan Kongbo, who's with the 49ers.
Yeah, and even Jordan Williams, who has
played
with his hand down as a backup defensive tackle with the Titans as well. So, yeah, that's the deepest position for Tennessee, and it's the biggest position represented by Tennessee in the NFL right now.
Probably the best position for Tennessee defensively, maybe. I don't know. I mean, he's had a fine year or a fine career. Billy Jackson with the Eagles, defensive tackle. Dan McCullers, an opportunity to step up and see. I mean, he's a crafty veteran. He's been around for a while, but he might see his role increase significantly this year with the Steelers. And then you've seen Shy Tuttle, who came on as an undrafted guy, but has really worked himself into a key contributor for the Saints.
Well, Eric, I might disagree with you a little bit here. I might go Shy Tuttle over McCullers. Now, McCullers has had he's been in the league a lot longer, and he's had more productivity. But when they've had a hole at that position, they've always brought someone else in, either via the draft or free agency, and kept McCullers as the backup.
Yeah.
So I think you get a limited number of snaps with him. And I think you had more explosive plays from a Shy Tuttle. So I might start Tuttle there.
Yeah, and that's fair. I mean, completely Shy Tuttle's made that impact. Move on to linebacker. It's getting a little thinner now. You've got A.J. Johnson of the Broncos, Jalen Reeves-Maben would be the other starter, even though he can play outside as well. He's with the Lions, and really the only other linebacker that you could throw in there. Jordan Williams of the Titans is kind of a flex of where he plays a little all over, but we kind of classify him as a defensive lineman. But also Daniel Betuli, who was just signed an undrafted free agent deal with the Rams. But the two starters would be A.J. Johnson, Jalen Reeves-Maybe, right?
Yeah, I might go 4-2-5 lineups and get an extra DB in there.
Yeah, for sure. There are some DBs, and quickly, we're about to run out of time. Maybe not a whole lot of safety presence, because my two starters will be Rashawn Golden, who's fighting for a roster spot with the Giants, Nigel Warrior, who will do the same with the Ravens. But it is cornerback you here of late. You've got Cameron Sutton, Justin Coleman. Of course, both those guys can play the nickel. Emmanuel Mosley, who has made a presence for the 49ers as well. Those three guys have really done nice work in the NFL.
Yeah, Mosley had some starts for the 49ers and got to the Super Bowl last year. So, yeah, good corners there. And people would not have expected it with Coleman and Mosley based on what they did at UT, because fans were on those guys a lot during their time at UT.
Two punters, Britton Colquitt, Michael Pilardi, and long snapper Morgan Cox kind of rounds it out. Kind of a fun exercise. I might post this on Twitter later, but, of course, you can look at all the Vols in the NFL, where they are, their current situations, Vince's views up at 99.1thesportsanimal.com. Boys, it's been fun. Vince, we'll do it again here in the coming weeks. And, Logan, appreciate all the work you did today, man.
Thanks, Eric.
All right, thank you most of all for listening. You've got the Lead Lap coming up next here at 10 to noon before the Vol Network Classic showcases at noon today. It's the 1998 Tennessee overtime win against Florida. For Vince Farrar, Logan Ward, I'm Eric Kane. This has been Saturday Sports Talk on the Sports Animal.